morning. I'm going to call the Customer Service and Operations and Security Committee to order. We are absent the District of Columbia, so we'll start the agenda and go into some of the presentations. We'll come back for the approval of the agenda in minutes. And I will start with the safety. Mr. Lavin, if you would like to give us that message.
The emergency exits are located to my left and right behind me. In the event of emergency, we'll gather across the street at the Building Museum. The automated external defibrillator is behind the guard desk, and restrooms are also to the right of the guard desk if anyone needs them. Today's safety contact will be on seasonal driving. With fewer hours of daylight, it can be difficult to see pedestrians or cyclists clearly. So if you don't have automatic headlights in your vehicle, make sure you manually turn on your headlights at the onset of dusk. In the mornings, the sun can be extremely bright, making it difficult to see the brake lights ahead. Keep a pair of sunglasses in your car to reduce glare to protect your vision. Temperatures can also affect driving performance. Clear your windshield of frost before beginning your journey and turn on your defogger if necessary. Frost can also form on road surfaces without being visible, so be cautious in wooded areas, bridges, and overpasses where ice can develop quickly. Also remember, wet leaves can make for a very slippery surface. Another good practice is to keep an emergency kit in your trunk, which you can find at your local automotive store. However, if you want to create your own, be sure to include a flashlight, first aid kit, and jumper cables. Windshield, washer fluid, and basic tools. You might even consider purchasing a battery charger if you have a long commute each day. Safe travels.
Thank you very much. We have two items today that we will be taking up: vital signs with our key performance indicators and the metro performance that measures our metro performance and delivers the quality service of the system. The next item that will follow will be the preventive maintenance plan. It is an overview of the preventive maintenance work that is planned for the night work window provided by each of the 4 hours of service scenarios now being considered by the board. The public engagement process has concluded with over 15,000 surveys submitted and over 700 emails submitted, with over 60 people speaking at our public hearings. The results of the outreach and input will be brought back to the board in December for a decision on the service hours. We want to begin with the performance indicators, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Burnside.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Hudgens and members of the committee. Today I'm going to be making a brief presentation on the quarter three results, which is covering the months of July to September of this year. First, fall is the time of year that we start thinking about our key performance indicator targets for the following year. And this graphic shows how targets fit into the overall picture of performance management. So briefly, kind of starting on the left side at the top, the board identifies the direction for the agency via a set of 4 strategic goals. Those were created back in 2012 around safety, quality service, connect communities, and invest in our people and assets. Key indicators then help the board track progress towards those goals in a measurable way. Targets define what success looks like, in other words, kind of the goalpost. Department business plans and actions help us plan the work and identify resources. And then finally, as you're sitting here today reviewing the quarterly vital signs report, they help communicate progress towards 3 of our 4 goals quarterly. And on an annual basis, we add in the Connect Communities goal, which we've kind of called the board's goals in the past. And that's presented as part of the annual report. That'll be my next report. We're preparing for 2017 target setting with the GM and executive management team in a few weeks, gathering historical data, identifying planned work and expected investments, looking at historical trends, multi-year trends, and we're going to follow up with a communication to the board on the results of those discussions. Okay. In the interest of time, I'll highlight the results very quickly, and you can review the detail in the technical report at your leisure. So starting with safety and security, both customer and employee injuries were worse than target and increased compared to the same time last year. But on a year-to-date basis, the rates are similar to last year, and employee injury rate is actually down very slightly. What are we doing about it? We're focusing on safety compliance during SafeTrack, intensive SafeTrack work. We're also emphasizing defensive driving techniques because, frankly, collisions are what really drives a majority of injuries. The crime rate exceeded target this quarter. It's calculated as part one crimes divided by passengers riding our system. So although we did see an 11% decrease in the number of total crimes, because the there was also a decrease in ridership during the quarter, it drove the rate up. In December, the committee is going to hear a presentation from the police with an in-depth crime report, including some of the actions underway that are listed on the screen. So I won't go into detail here. You'll hear some more about that in a month. Moving to the next slide, quality service bus. In quarter three, we normally experience a steep decline in on-time performance as seasonal road congestion increases in September when all the students come back to school and the commuters go back to work after summer vacations. We continue to see this trend this year, but on-time performance is 3% worse than last year. And buses are arriving early more frequently than last year. One area of concern for the committee last time I presented was late-night service performance, and late night is 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. Late-night service continues to decline in the quarter I'm reporting on with an increasing number of early arrivals. So you may ask, what does early mean? Metro measures bus on-time performance as adherence to schedule, the actual time arriving at a series of time points within a window of no more than 2 minutes early and 7 minutes late. So if you are more than 2 minutes early at a time point, that is considered an early. Early arrivals are within management's control. So a corrective action plan has been developed for late night service, which can also help all time periods. And that includes better communication with operators, use of technology to manage schedule adherence, and then also just reviewing our schedules to make sure that they are accurate to the traffic conditions and the conditions in which the buses are operating. So for example, we're currently analyzing the impact on on-time performance during late night of major events in the downtown area, which can actually surprisingly generate quite a lot of traffic that late at night. Things at the Verizon Center, Nationals Park, RFK Stadium, and some of the West End Entertainment. Moving to bus fleet reliability, with extreme temperatures in quarter three, bus fleet reliability performed slightly below target, but is better than last year. And finally, bus customer satisfaction decreased significantly, and that's driven by inconsistent service delivery. Other aspects of the customer experience remain pretty consistent with previous years. Next slide. For rail, this is the first reporting quarter where we've seen the full impact of SafeTrack. Customer on-time performance was highest in July at 71%, but fell to 64% as the quarter progressed. And customers on all lines, with the exception of Green, were impacted by SafeTrack. But it's important to note that it's the unplanned disruption. So you could think of SafeTrack as a planned disruption. It's really the unplanned disruptions that account for the bulk of customer delays. And 60% of those are railcar related. Next would be infrastructure at 18%. Customer and police activities at about 12% and so on. Additionally, speed restrictions had a big impact on August and September performance. So we saw 150 speed restrictions during the time frame, and that was 20% more than last year, largely resulting from improved inspection protocols. Fleet reliability fell just short of target, but was better than last year, hampered by sustained record high temperatures in July, which is hard on our fleet. And that impacted propulsion and brake systems. HVAC failures were up 34% compared to last year, and that had an impact on car availability, and that caused it to drop sharply in July and August. Retirement of our 1000 series cars continues, with 90 cars removed by the end of the quarter, by September. And as you can imagine, the changing fleet composition, with the old cars going out and the new 7Ks coming in on a regular basis, is going to help us kind of increase that performance. A rail car maintenance blitz started this past Tuesday, which will last for about half a year. It targets the subsystems that account for about 60% of the rail car failures, and this is complemented by numerous engineering initiatives underway as well with rail cars. Finally, although it's not a significant decrease from the third quarter of last year, satisfaction for rail customers was below target, as less than half of customers perceived service as reliable. And that's one of the main drivers for rail customer satisfaction. And our final slide is elevator and escalator. Both these measures are green despite increases in unscheduled work. Such work orders stem from a more rigorous inspection process, often leading to repair of major components, things like motors, chains, or brakes. So for elevators, repairs took an average of 11 more hours this year versus last year, and for escalators, that number was 14 more hours. In closing, I'd like to highlight that the report now includes a section on ridership, which you will find on page 29 of 73 of your package. This is in response to a request by committee member Augustine, I believe it was, who said this is one of our most vital of statistics. This page will be enhanced in future reports to provide greater analysis on the drivers of ridership. We look forward to sharing that with you in future meetings. So that concludes my brief report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Burnside. And if there are some urgent questions, we'll take one or two, but we appreciate the presentation. We'd like to move on quickly and reference the report that's in the packet. If you have any questions, we can get some outside. Nothing urgent? Okay.
I did have one question, if I may. Ms. Burnside, this doesn't go to one of your slides, but in the actual KPI report, there was a discussion of, you know, rail car availability, and you had a chart showing the optimal passengers per car and when in the third quarter the standard was still being exceeded, both in the third quarter of 2015 and in the third quarter of 2016. And you have a bullet in there that says the year-to-year rush period ridership decrease in July was offset by significantly fewer rail cars observed for the month during both AM and PM rush periods, leading to overcrowding at multiple locations. And your charts show that there's still a number of points in Pentagon and Courthouse which exceeded the 100 standard. I thought we had a goal of 954 rail cars were needed to meet the peak needs. And so my question is, apparently, even though ridership has declined, we still have overcrowding because we're not hitting whatever we need in terms of rail cars. So I guess my question is, what do you have any information on what were the number of rail cars, since it must be lower than 954, that were actually being operated in the third quarter of 2015, causing these overcrowding situations?
Yes, so you're looking at page 22 in the package?
Yeah, mine says 23 of 74.
23, sorry, it's kind of hard to read. But. So when we went into the safe track mode, I believe we lowered the number of cars required, isn't that correct? We had lower car requirements, so 954 wasn't necessarily the target when we went into when we started the Safe Track program. But there is, as I said, fleet reliability is impacted by the heat, and so during the summer, oftentimes cars have to be taken out of service, and that can impact crowded conditions as cars are taken out of service. So while they may pull out in the morning, and that would be a measure that we look at. What's the pullout in the morning, you know, in terms of 954, whatever the reduced amount was for Safe Track. Sometimes they do have to be taken out of service, and that can impact crowding.
No, I appreciate the impressionistic. What I was trying to get at the metric, what was our target in the third quarter of 2015, and how many rail cars did we actually deliver? I'm trying to understand, what is our rail car delivery problem that's still out there? Is it 5%? Is it 10%? And what are we doing to correct it?
Well, I think as Andrea said, as Safe Track moves from surge to surge, the car count that's required changes. There were some Safe Tracks that were at the very ends of the lines that didn't really cause for a decrease, so the cars the cars needed for service stayed around 954, but at times the car count went down. Based on where the surge is. As Andrew did say, September and August and September was one of the bad months for the availability of our cars. We had that extreme heat wave in August where we saw a lot of cars going out of service for HVAC. So there were periods of time where we may start off in the morning with what we had with the required car count, but by midday we had trains that were coming out of service that would affect things like PM rush and stuff like that.
Can you, I want to go back and forth, because I know the chair wants it.
Yeah.
Could you just provide that data to the committee?
Okay.
What was your target in the
gotcha.
Third quarter of 2016, and how many cars did you actually provide?
Sure, we can provide a follow-up on that.
Not a problem.
I'm sorry, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. As I noted, we want to move on to the overnight maintenance presentation. I turn this over to Mr. Leader, and we began the presentation, and we're going to be, this is a long presentation, but we do want to go into the details of what's
sure.
here in front of us.
Good morning. At the last committee meeting, you requested a presentation on why we need more hours or the maintenance window that we currently are requesting. But before we get started with today's presentation, I would like to present with you just a fact. Over the last 12 months, deteriorating track and infrastructure have caused 18% of all train delays. This is not the most common cause of customer delays. The most common cause is car reliability right now. But it is without a doubt the most painful to our customers. These delays are a result of cracked rails, burning or smoldering insulators, lost power, or down signals. And what they result in are speed restrictions, single tracking, and emergency shutdowns. These delays can extend for hours as crews move into place, they troubleshoot the problem, and then make repairs. To tens of thousands of customers, this can mean a longer commute, packed trains, more delays, and headaches just trying to get where they want to go. So when SafeTrack was designed, it was targeted about 20% of the system where the worst conditions call for immediate action to ensure the safety of our system. A program like SafeTrack, if you were going to look at a different part of our life, a program like SafeTrack is very similar to open-heart surgery, but it's open-heart surgery for railroading. When you get to this point, it's an emergency operation. As a New Yorker, I have seen this before. In the 1980s, New York City Transit was reeling from decades of deferred maintenance and no dedicated funds. There were no preventative maintenance programs in place, and there were hundreds of red tag locations. That's what we called it back then. There were hundreds of slow speeds, anywhere from a half mile to a mile that could go. A 10-minute commute in 1980 could take 40 minutes for the average customer. There were 30 derailments in 1980 in New York City Transit, and in 1982, there was a derailment every 27 days. That's what spurred the creation of the Capital Program. Here at Metro, it's time to strengthen the programs we have. Andy Off and staff will present his plan for updating the preventative maintenance programs of our railroad so that our system can get healthy, stay healthy, and that we do not need any emergency room operations like SafeTrack in the future. So with those comments, I'd like to turn it over to Andy.
No, thank you, Mr. Leader. Good morning, ma'am. Today I'll be presenting on our preventive maintenance program. And the intent of today's briefing is to answer or attempt to answer many of the questions that have been asked to the tune of why do you need the more time, what are you going to do with the extra time, and why we can't segment the system, what do other properties do, and the like. So the picture here on our opening slide is of an insulator failure that we experienced at Federal Center in May, and the preventive maintenance programs we're going to talk about today are particularly focused to remediate and find problems of this nature before they result in unscheduled delays to our customers. Why is more time needed? The bottom line is, we need to make the move from reactive maintenance to preventive maintenance. We spend an overwhelming majority of our time correcting components that have already failed. As an example, SafeTrack is not preventive maintenance. SafeTrack is the act of replacing components that have already failed. The theory behind preventive maintenance is to fix and remediate components prior to their failure and before they result in delays for our customers. We refer internally to our preventive maintenance program as the anti-SafeTrack, the antithesis of what we're doing now. We do not want to do SafeTrack 2.0 due to the disruption and of course, the extreme labor burden it puts on the workforce. How will that time be used? The following slides will lay out the details of the five programs numbered here. And a lot of these programs were supported by numerous external sources to include three APTA peer reviews, four NTSB recommendations, and eight FTA corrective action reports, to include an international consultant that came in and reviewed our maintenance practices and how we utilize track access. All corroborated, you know, this theory that we're presenting today, that we do not do adequate preventive maintenance. We need to get away from corrective maintenance, and in order to do that, we need more time on the railroad to make those changes. The first program we'll talk about this morning is cable measuring. In the right hand above the picture, you'll see five related incidents, 2016 to date. For each one of these programs, we'll highlight, theoretically, how many of these incidents we could have got out in front of if, in fact, we were executing these preventive maintenance programs. Cable measuring is the way that you determine the health of the cable prior to it failing. You know, some of these are buried in conduit pipes underground, very difficult to do any sort of visual observation. We have about 13,500 cables in the system, and these would be done about once every 4 years. So in order to do this work, we would need about 19 hours of productive work per week in order to maintain the standard. The picture to the right is of the cable fire we experienced at Metro Center in September, just the prior month, and that was, or excuse me, 2 months ago now, and that was a case where, you know, the cable had lost its capability to properly insulate the electrical current, and we didn't know. Cable measuring is a program that gets out in front of that and will enable us to find and replace those cables before they do fail. Next program is stray current testing. As some may be aware, our running rails and our fasteners serve as the conduit to move electricity from the rail car back to the substation, so they are, in fact, part of the circuit. In order for them to perform properly, they need to be insulated. We don't want the electrical current getting out of the running rails and into the stud bolts and into the fasteners. The picture here is of a phenomenon we do see when we do have current that's not properly isolated in the running rails. This has accounted for about 83 incidents year to date. The primary cause is when you have these stray current anomalies, it does wreak havoc on your signaling system and causes your circuits to bob and go out of correspondence. Again, this is a program that would require about 10 hours a week, but this is one of the programs where we need longer windows, about 3 to 4 hours a night in order to properly execute this program, because it entails tearing the rails apart. You have to break them at either end. You induce a voltage into the running rail, and then you determine where that current is leaking based upon lower resistive values than is designed. Next program is tamping and surfacing, probably the most fundamental railroad maintenance program for quite a while, since the existence of railroads. On the right-hand side here, you'll see a picture of one of our four tampers out in the safe track zone. We do tamp, but primarily as a function of installing new cross ties. We need to start doing this as a preventive maintenance function where we tamp out of phase. This helps us correct the geometry of a railroad, extends the life of your tie by ensuring that there's proper rock underneath there to keep it properly supported. Blocking and tackling type of stuff includes our switches, and our intent would to tamp all mainline track once every 2 years, and our switches once a year. In order to meet that requirement, we would need about 20 hours a week of productive work in order to meet those requirements. Switch welding and grinding. Just yesterday, we had a slow speed put in place at Grosvenor on the outbound track due to a cracked frog. This is exactly what this program's getting after. Welding frog points, grinding switches, grinding frogs, very basic interlocking maintenance. As we know, interlockings are dangerous places. They need to be maintained properly. Fundamentally, the industry standard, you know, is to weld your frogs, grind your frogs, grind your switch points to ensure you maintain that proper wheel-rail interface before it does result in a passenger delay. Mechanical joint maintenance. Mechanical joints, also a very high-risk area on the railroad. Although in theory we are a continuously welded railroad, we do have approximately 1,200 open joints in the system. This is due to replacing rail due to defects and things of that nature. We also experience, to the tune of about 28 incidents to date this calendar year, where we've had broken bolts, broken joint bars. Some may be familiar with those connotations. This is where we get out there, tighten the bolts, inspect the joints, make sure they're nice and tight and firm so that we don't experience unscheduled delays. Other preventive maintenance programs that we want to get out there and do, many of which have been noted in various external reports, primarily fire life safety related, fire extinguishers, emergency trip stations, emergency egress, and also torquing of our direct fixation fasteners. Of the three highest risk areas, more likely are your tight curves, your mechanical joints, and your interlockings. So we're specifically designing preventive maintenance programs to go after these three areas where if we do have a problem, it's more than likely to be within that part of the infrastructure. How do we use the time we have? This is just intended to define what the railroad environment looks like from our maintenance away worker perspective. So the top bar shows a normal five-hour non-passenger window between midnight and 5. The green and orange boxes that we'll refer to as the shoulders show some of the activities that need to happen prior to the productive work happening within the black box. So on the left, although we close at midnight, I think most are aware you can tap into Metro Center at about 11:55 or so and take a train up to Shady Grove and get dropped off about 12:30, 12:40 or so. Same applies to Wheely. The last train off the system is typically coming out of Wheely at about 1:30. So on average, the main line is clear of revenue trains at approximately 1 o'clock in the morning. Varies from line to line, things of that nature. But the bottom line is the railroad is not open at midnight. There is still a lot of revenue train movement up till about 1 o'clock. After 1 o'clock, that's when we start moving our crews and their equipment out of the yards, which are on the periphery of the system. That takes quite a while to move them in safely. And then, we go through a work setup, power up, power down, roadway worker protection protocol, which results in then you have the same activities of breaking down your work site. And then our first revenue train in the morning is pulling out of the yard at about 0420. So certainly there, although we do have 5 hours of non-passenger service, the end result is about 2 hours of productive work in a five-hour non-revenue window. So the picture below that shows what a weekend looked like prior to SafeTrack. So if we closed at 3 and opened at 7, and you account for the movement of trains and setting up the work zones, we essentially had 1 hour of productive work. So we did not work on Friday and Saturday nights. Our crews were scheduled Sunday through Thursday night, and the only work we did on Fridays and Saturday nights was primarily emergency response type work. Many questions have been asked about our efficiencies and what we can do to shorten both the green and the orange boxes. We do acknowledge that there are efficiencies to be gained in those two shoulders. However, the amount of efficiency to be gained there is not overly significant, and it certainly wouldn't be timely in enough manner to address these pressing issues. Roadway worker protection, is a very important aspect of what we do. And as we would need to change that or implement technologies to expedite how we put power down and power back up, that is something that we would certainly need to do in a very deliberate and well thought out manner. So how do we get the time needed? So the block above shows a typical weekend, 3 to 7, pre-safe track where we did not work. The block below that shows how we produce 3 to 4 hours of productive work on both Friday and Saturday night by closing at midnight, opening at 7, and accounting for the shoulders that we have for moving trains and setting up work zones. So what we basically got out of closing at midnight was going from 0 hours of work on Friday and Saturday night to about 8 hours of work between those two evenings. So, significant increase. That's been very productive and certainly will be critical if we are to carry out this preventive maintenance program. So we do have various options. The block on the left shows the amount of productive work we had in a given week before SafeTrack, 10 hours. given that we get about 2 hours of productive work over the five evenings, Sunday through Thursday. As we move to, you know, this plan where in general we would go from 33 hours of non-passenger service to 41 hours of non-passenger service, about a 5% decrease in passenger service hours over the course of 168-hour, 7-day week. then the way this kind of works out is if you look over an annualized basis, these proposals would impact about 0.5% of our ridership. So what we get out of those negative impacts is we're able to double the amount of productive work we can get every week from 10 to 20 hours. The red bars denote what we would call a normal work window, 2 to 3 hours of work. The blue boxes show the amount of extended work windows we would get, a work window of 3 to 4 hours. So in other words, there are some preventive maintenance activities that we need to have those extended work windows to execute out satisfactorily, stray current, cable measuring. So although all the options, you know, do work, there are some that are more beneficial for some of our preventive maintenance programs. But the bottom line of this slide is just to show that, you know, by impacting less than 1% of our ridership, we're able to double the amount of productive work we can achieve each week. What does everyone else do? Certainly this is a question we hear frequently. We certainly do understand and appreciate, you know, the observations and comparisons to other transit systems. From an engineering perspective, I would tell you they are very, very different systems, and we'll talk about a few of those examples. At times, we've talked about the Chicago work out on the Dan Ryan Red Line and how they pursued that work. Under that program, that rail was built in 1969, was when it was put in service, approximately 7 years before our first section of track opened between Farragut North and Rhode Island Avenue in 1976. In 2010, the Chicago Transit Authority awarded about a $425 million contract to shut down that 10-mile segment of track for 5 months, and they rebuilt it from the ground up. You know, certainly a technique at the time that they did that, approximately 40% of that 10-mile stretch of track was under a slow zone, and it had been for quite some time. So certainly just, you know, that is one way, you know, to maintain an asset. Certainly not advisable, but that is a technique. Relating it to our system, that would be effectively or synonymous to closing from Vienna to Clarendon for 5 months to rebuild that section of track. If you take a look at Atlanta, the system we're nearly most like, they have all concrete ties. We have all wood ties. That debate is alive and well, and I'm, you know, certainly wouldn't say one is better than the other. They are just different. Concrete tie is about 4 times heavier than a wood tie. The tamping and surfacing cycle on a concrete tie is about 4 times less than a wood tie. We have wood ties, and they require, you know, more frequent tamping and surfacing, just as an example. Certainly Atlanta doesn't run the tonnage or, you know, the headways we have. That has, you know, some points. And I think if you look at, you know, our system in terms of systems complexity, when you think about heating and air conditioning systems, you know, no columns, sight lines in the stations, and things of that nature, you quickly decipher that from an engineering perspective, our system is very complex and certainly not the same as many others. Why can't we surge instead? It really becomes a time and space problem. The picture on the right shows a night of when we're working, overnight hours. On this specific evening of September 7th, our track crews occupied 164 of the 234 miles of track on the system. So approximately 70% of the system was occupied by work crews. On average, every night we have 57 different work crews in the system. So simply trying to fix this problem with more crews just becomes a volume problem because there's just not available space, you know, to push more labor if we intend to really move the reliability needle. SafeTrack has not touched the core. So the red shaded track indicates surges that we have completed. The yellow shows surges that are planned but not yet completed, and the gray shows where we do not intend to surge. The thickness of the line indicates the volume of ridership. So the intent here is just to understand. So under our current surge, we're impacting 50% of the ridership west of NOMA. And that's for, you know, where it is. So if you think of something from McPherson to Smithsonian, you know, under a surge in the core, it would require about an 85% diversion in service in order to execute that under a surge logic. And we'd be running probably about 24-minute headways through that surge zone if we were to approach this in a segmented logic. Next. From an arithmetic perspective, when we did a planning exercise to attempt to model what it would look like to execute this preventive maintenance program using a surge approach, it would require 55 different surge events. About 450 days of those 2 years would be actual surges. The delta would be time in between breaking down and setting up the next surge, accounting for inclement weather and when we can't do work, inauguration, and other special events of that nature. From a cost perspective, we spend approximately $100,000 a day supporting our surge events in terms of bus operators, buses, police to manage the crowds. Our safety personnel are conducting additional crowd control exercises, and then certainly our media relations teams who are on the platforms helping to distribute information and help our customers navigate around the surge. So if we applied this burn rate to these surges, it would be a total of about $42 million in additional support costs in order to execute the program using a surge logic. Certainly, we've been asked how we will know this is working. Certainly a difficult question to answer. We are in the process of building metrics that are segmented specifically. You know, we're looking in between interlockings and in between stations so we can speak more intelligently about reliability of specific track segments of the system. This will be used to, you know, track, traction power, and signal would tend to be the, you know, primary causes of infrastructure delays to our customers. This will enable us to, you know, speak more intelligently, and certainly I'm sure that's something we would want to share with the public and our team to show how we're doing pre- and post-SafeTrack. But in order to do that in any meaningful way, it needs to be very targeted on the specific section of track for which we did surge, and then it needs to be tied, you know, to those segments within the system so we make sure we're, you know, we're providing accurate information. Relative to the preventive maintenance program, it certainly is something, once we start executing, we could measure that immediately in terms of using this new metric and see, you know, hey, we did frog welding, you know, at this interlocking, which is within this segment. Have we seen improved reliability? Have we not? What changes do we need to make, or are we doing well? But we would offer that in order to really make some good judgment calls about the effectiveness of the preventive maintenance program, it would require one pass or a two-year cycle, at which time we, you know, we could look back, take some lessons learned, and better understand, are we moving the reliability needle, and what are the things we need to do to sustain this or change it to make it better? And what if we don't? The things we're presenting today are, you know, merely fundamental programs that we have not carried out to any reasonable standard in the past. They need to be done. And if we don't do them, we would, you know, foresee ourselves falling, you know, back into a safe track or surge type logic. At some point, we need to get away from fixing stuff that is already broken and get more into a cycle where we're maintaining what we have and not allowing it to break, thus not resulting in a passenger delay. So certainly some, you know, pivotal decisions. You know, the safety trump service logic, you know, applies to our customers and our workforce, certainly led to SafeTrack, the act of replacing stuff that is already broken. The preventive maintenance program we're proposing today is to correct things that have not broken and to deliver more reliable service. there's been approximately 659 incidents to date that are related to infrastructure delays. Of those, we believe that our preventive maintenance programs theoretically could have mitigated 57% of those. So when we talk about, accountability and measuring the success of this program, we believe that if we, carry this out through a two-year cycle, that we would have the capability to increase our reliability by two, or cut the number of infrastructure-related delays in half. That was the 18% that Mr. Leader and Ms. Burnside mentioned earlier. So that's what we're getting after in this preventive maintenance program. And that concludes my presentation, pending your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Off. Let me do one housekeeping piece and get that out of the way so that we won't leave it off, and that is that we do the approval of the minutes. And for those members, is there a motion?
So moved. Oh, second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation, and I think it gives us a chance to walk through and make certain so that when we get to the decision point about the service options that are on the table, we have gotten as much information as possible. And I'm going to put it in the framework of buying a new refrigerator and figuring out what happens. It tells you that you're going to have a life cycle of X, and that you have a maintenance cycle that goes on a period of time. And the assumption is that if I defer those maintenance, I may lose some value in my life cycle, or I may actually lose the whole refrigerator. And I kind of figure out, where are we now? Are we back at the loss of a refrigerator and trying to put it all back together and move forward? The questions that we've all heard around the public process is, what about these things? And many of them you've walked through, but one I think you didn't walk through that I would like to ask the question, and then I open it up to the members and the other board members that are present. A lot of people talk about, how about more people out there? Why can't we just put more people out on the road, railroad, and see if we can get more work done?
Yes, ma'am. When we talk about efficiencies, on an average night, we put 57 crews out on the railroad every evening. Certainly one way to become more inefficient is to attempt to get more crews out there. Every single crew, needs to move from a yard location to the wayside, set up their work equipment, and then get authority to go to work. That's one challenge. Of course, the most prominent just being the time and space analogy. When you occupy 164 of the 234 miles of track on any given night, trying to put more resources on that asset in order to properly maintain it just becomes a volume challenge, and simply one we would love for that to be a viable solution to carry out this preventive maintenance program, but the math simply doesn't work.
Okay, I'm going to open it up. Mr. Mountain.
Thank you for the presentation. It's very enlightening. And I really don't challenge the need to do this maintenance, but after the public hearing, we're hearing statement after statement of how much of a disruption this is going to be for the area to have the restricted hours. Through the SafeTrack program, it's basically built on closing down one track, doing heavy maintenance on that track, while still maintaining service on the other side. And I know that we don't want to go to Surge 2.0, but it seems to me that since we have a two-track system here, that expanded work zones could be established in the evenings on one track while maintaining a level of service on the other, especially if this is in the evenings when we have 20-minute headways, we don't have as many trains out there, don't have as many passengers, don't have, as much congestion. And I know that there's challenges in turning off power. I know that there's challenges in fouling other tracks. But tell me, why wouldn't a solution that basically shut down one track early, maybe 8 o'clock in the evening, work on that from 8 o'clock to the following morning, get these things done, get your measuring done, get all these things that you want to do while maintaining 20-minute headway on the other track? Why isn't that an option?
Yes, sir, and you mentioned measuring. That's a good example. Our system, unlike some others, is what, I don't intend to get tech, but it's the electrical infrastructure is cross-bonded. So electrically, track one and track two are connected. In order to cable measure, in order to do stray current testing, both tracks need to be down, just as an example for that specific preventive maintenance program.
All right, let me just say, you know, during SafeTrack, one was up and one was down. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
Okay, so maybe measuring is a particular case that needs a special action. But what about the other things you talked about? What about, you know, grinding frogs and doing inspections and these other things? Do they all require that both tracks be shut down at the same time?
No, sir. No, sir. That I wanted to address the specific example. So there are many when you look, SafeTrack is really all about, the efficiency gained is all about wood ties. We are not doing preventive maintenance, you know, within SafeTrack. When you look at the amount of equipment and the amount of material and manpower that needs to deploy to a SafeTrack zone to do wood cross ties.
All right, I understand that, but I guess my question is, have you looked at the option of doing single tracking during low usage times, late in the evenings, to give you the larger window on the other track to do this maintenance? Have you considered that as one of the possible ways to get these maintenance windows in place, or have you only looked at shutting the entire system down each time?
I think, yes, we have. And I think at the last meeting, it was one of the comments I made. The preventive maintenance moves. So it's not like we have early outs right now on a red line to perform scraping work and stuff that came out in an FDA cap. But for the most part, those early outs are staying in the same location for days and weeks. If you go to a preventive maintenance cycle, that single track is moving every day. So for just the communication to the customers and the disruption to the customers, moving it constantly will be a problem.
Is there really a disruption on a 20-minute headway train? I can understand, you know, during rush hour there's obviously a disruption because the trains stack up all over town. But on a 20-minute headway late in the evening, is that really an issue?
I just think from a communication standpoint, getting it out, it is. But I think what we are trying to do is to go with one solution. I think what I'm hearing is go with a measuring preventive maintenance program that has one type of solution versus, you know, some of our other programs. So what we're trying to do is establish a program that is consistent and steady that will, once we go with it, it will stay steady in a steady state for a few years.
Ms. Mason wants to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in to get to the answer to your question. We did look at it, and we put it up here on the slide, and perhaps it's too subtle. When we looked at it, and what we're doing under SafeTrack is we have a surge in one location, and we have early outs or late night single tracking in another. But there's a practical limit to the number of areas you can single track at the same time after 8 p.m. in terms of the number of lines you can do. So what we looked at was you'd probably get a maximum of about 15 work crews out there during passenger service while still providing a reasonable level of service to everyone else, 20-minute headways. 15 crews is about a quarter of what we need to put out there, right? Right now we're putting out almost 60 crews on average, and these are additional programs we would want to execute that each take from 10 to 20 hours per week. So the math just doesn't work. Early outs or late night signal tracking does not give us enough track access to replace this program.
All right. Yeah. Can we go back to the what are the options slide, please? First of all, I just want to say that I really appreciate this presentation, and I think it's very important for us to, it was a good point where we talked about prioritizing safety over service, and that this is a matter of prioritizing reliability over service, although they're competing interests, but I actually wouldn't consider it that way. I still think, though, that we have to take care of service, and these are tough decisions that have to be made. I am mindful of the potential for people being disrupted in these late night hours, but something always has to give. This slide right here, which shows a decrease of 1% of the ridership while doubling our productive work time, which means, and as you said, not on this slide, but another, but then with half the service disruptions for our riders, for the 100% of the riders, for 100%, while only impacting 1%, is just so stark to me. I mean, it is very stark that we would be able to gain that much in productivity. Because if we look at, within this committee, customer satisfaction, which is just so very low, and we know that reliability is a key driver of that, and we're working on it with the trains, which is great, although you put a slide, the previous slide in there, it said 29 trains, but it's not the 29, it's like 168, right? I mean, not on this one, but on the, just as far as like the number of cars, it said trains, but no, those are train sets. So we're working on that. I've talked at length about trying to get our program turned around. I think that this is a continuation of that, and that this will help us to get the program turned around, get more reliable, along with the, obviously with the trains, so that we can start seeing people come back because it's a system that's much more reliable. So I think that you really haven't emphasized as strongly as I hope that you would the benefits of this versus basically the costs, which are real, but the costs. Thank you.
I just want to say I appreciate those comments, and I just want to, I'll go back to my opening statement where I talked about New York. I was born in New York. I lived through New York. I rode the subways back in the 70s and the 80s. And the more we continue to skimp in the hours of service that we get to perform the maintenance we need, we will definitely be back in another safe track. And we don't want to go that way. We really need the time to get out there, put these programs out, and just get back to really the just the nuts and the bolts of what real maintenance is. It's just really getting back to the basics, you know, of what we should be doing out there. And I think this is what staff has come up with. I think it's a great plan. And I think, you know, once we get this thing, this plan moving forward, you know, we're going to see the reliability of the track area definitely improve.
Mr. Garcia.
So thank you very much. I think this has been very informative and very responsive to, I think, the board's desire to really unpack whether or not this was just a desire to have more hours to do an ineffective program or what would be different about this. So I think it speaks very well that you well thought out what you would do with these extra hours. But it also begs the question, further inquiry into what we have been doing now. And we understand from your presentation that the weekends have essentially been useless for preventive maintenance. What about the week? What about the program that you want to implement moving forward? How have we been going about doing those during the week hours? I'm certainly not an engineer, but it seems like many of those programmatic elements are, you know, real standard basic stuff. You're not reinventing the wheel here. How have we been trying to accomplish that with the weekday hours that we've had?
Yes, sir. My first slide had a seesaw on it where, you know, where we want to shift that effort from corrective maintenance to preventive maintenance. The bottom line is probably about 90% of the work we do every night is all corrective maintenance. We're addressing failures that have already happened in the system. Yesterday, we put in place 6 speed restrictions on our morning conference call this morning. Our track maintenance crews, all we could talk about was the work they did in response to the 6 speed restrictions that were put in place yesterday. So I think, you know, this program is intended to get out in front of those unscheduled delays so that the crews were scheduled to do preventive maintenance last night actually did it. They're not reacting to corrective maintenance situations that come about during the course of the day.
But just to, I think, if I understood the question, when you looked at our surfacing program, there was no surfacing program. The surfacing that was done during project work on the weekends when we had 55 hours to work. You looked at our megarine. We had a megarine program here years ago, and it went away. When it came to our straight current program, same thing. So these are programs that may have existed in somewhat in Metro, but prior to with SafeTrack, they were non-existent.
You know, as impressive, Mr. Augustine, as I agree with you as to what this is going to look like moving forward, I think that also is a point of emphasis that we should all just really absorb, is that for however many number of years, we have been abrogating our responsibility to perform fundamental preventive maintenance according to industry standards, and it's just, what's that? It's quite disappointing.
I think the question is, do we continue doing that? And I think that's really the question, because if you think of the history, each time, and I will put Mr. Wiedefeld in the seat where others were and say, we need this time, the answer has been no. And so the question is the answer no again? And I think maybe the question also is, and I would think of our prior presentation where we did the vital signs and we talked about customer service and reliability and safety. Are we going to be safer? Will our service be more reliable if we continue, or we use one of those options that takes away that preventive maintenance time and try to package it in one of the alternatives? And the question is, as I understand your answer, Mr. Aw, the reliability in SafeTrack is not really what our customers want. I mean, we're disrupting that service anyway, and yet we cannot get to the preventive maintenance, which is the most consistent part of the safety issue that we should be addressing.
Yes, ma'am, I would agree.
Okay. Ms. Hudgens, could I ask just one more, and then
yes.
I promise I'll be done. So, you know, Mr. Wiedefeld, you've now suggested that you consider this a temporary proposal, one that we would reevaluate in a little while. It's going to be tough to really reevaluate and do something different towards an eye of extending service if this PM proposal is really designed to get at those fundamental things that have to be done. So how are we, over the course of the next 2 years, also going to pursue the kinds of efficiencies that may in fact create the possibility that we could think about extended service hours at some point?
That I think was the orange boxes in the prior charts. We are working on that. I think what we need to do is there's two areas we need to look at. Number one is roadway worker protection. How do we move forward? I've asked staff to begin looking at the various tasks that we can do. Is there other means of roadway worker protection that we can provide to allow us to get down there quicker, instead of waiting for power off or red tag? So that is one area, roadway worker protection. And as Andy mentioned, it's retooling the workforce, you know, because it will probably mean bringing in new safety equipment, training, as well as, you know, so that will take some time. The second thing that we're looking at is the lockout tag out procedure that we have, because it is taking about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on the length of the search or the length of track that you're taking out, okay, in order to safely bring down power and to ensure that it's locked out. So we are going to be looking at hopefully some technologies that might be out there that we could do it differently but safely, and that's what we're doing. So, but that will take some time. It's nothing that can be done overnight.
Mr. Smedberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Off, you mentioned the Chicago system. My company's HQ is there, and I ride that system often. They're doing a lot of work on that now. So what is, it seems like you sort of hinted you see some benefits to that model. What would be an objection with moving forward with, say, a model like that? Is it rider concerns, logistics, costs, other?
And my apologies, sir, I must have misled you.
Okay.
I was suggesting that would, you know, I don't think that's an approach we would support in terms of, you know, running an asset to failure and then shutting down, you know, 10 miles for 5 months. We wouldn't propose that.
I thought, you know, it was more the approach, not the.
Well, I think in that example, the intent was to, you know, just say, hey, here's a way, you know, to maintain
okay.
a railroad. It's not one that we would, you know, certainly endorse just due to the exorbitant impacts that it has on our customers.
Okay.
I think that kind of approach, though, is extremely dangerous from a risk standpoint, because although that was on that track was under slow speed, or a good portion of it was under slow speed, at any time you could have a significant or catastrophic failure.
Okay.
So that approach of allowing an asset to get down to the point where it's at zero life is not where you should be. You should be trying to get to that asset, what we used to call between 0 and 5 years. So you're looking at that asset over every year, you're looking at it, but somewhere when it gets down near the five-year mark, you're looking to renew it and not wait for it to catastrophically fail.
Ms. Porter was next.
I apologize if you've already talked about this. I just got out of audits committee, so I missed the earlier part of the discussion. But there was a discussion about, and I can't remember where I saw this, a discussion about whether you could do more if you had more crews working simultaneously. And I believe that I read, Mr. Arthur, that you said that having more crews working simultaneously is less efficient, not more efficient. And I didn't really understand that concept.
Yes, ma'am. So in one of the slides, we indicated that on a given evening, our crews occupy 164 of the 234 miles of available track, mainline track. And on any given night, we have approximately 57 crews working on the wayside. So what we were suggesting that is that it really becomes a problem of available volume, that there's not enough space out there to put more crews. When you look at the efficiencies of moving 57 crews out of the yard, setting up their work location, adding a few more would only take longer for each one of those respective crews to set up their work zones, you know, as they're naturally going out of the yard in sequence or behind one another. So simply putting more, you know, labor resources on it is not going to get us where we need to be due to the time constraint, or excuse me, the, you know, time and space constraints that we have on the railroad.
Is there a way to get around that by making them start from different locations? I'm out of my area of expertise here, and I apologize if we're covering areas, but could you start them from different locations rather than having them start all in the same place? Or is it a question of managing resources, or is there some sort of physical mathematical limitation on the number of crews you can handle?
I would suggest we do move from various locations. We have 8 yard locations where all of our equipment deploys out of. Many activities, they direct report to the work location and enter through the station. So it certainly is not, you know, all 57 crews in a line accessing. It's coming from many different locations. But certainly if we, you know, if there's 8 crews coming out of Shady Grove, adding a 9th, it's just going to be that much later until the 9th crew gets out there, because they're going to have to, you know, wait for the other crews to mobilize.
Mr. Balchi.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Look, you just startled me by saying that we used to do X, Y with power. We don't do it anymore. We used to do something else. We don't do it anymore. Two-part question. How does that happen, that we used to do stuff that was necessary, and now we don't, and the board, this committee, just finds out about it this morning? And second part, Madam Chairman, I would propose that we get a metric every month, and you're going to help us put this metric together about what we used to do and or what we're currently doing, and if we're doing it, continue to do it or not doing it, or we dropped it or we enhanced it. And so we know every month or every time we meet that stuff is getting done and not getting dropped. So first part is, how does this stuff happen? And you're going to help us put a metric together. So part one.
I would say, being that I've only been here 3 months, I would say it would be time. Okay? There was more time years ago to work on the
Chambers track. Brothers, time? Where, what are you talking about, time?
But time-wise, the maintenance window. I think there was more time at one time to do the work, and it probably was taken away. But I just want to say, moving forward, it doesn't matter to me what happened in the past. It's what's happening now and where we want to go. That's what I can change, and that's what I'm tasked to do. okay?
So examples of what the changes are, when they were instituted. If you can't tell us the past, then fine.
Okay.
It's under the water under the bridge. I want the new stuff that you're installing, and I want to know if it ever gets amended, dropped.
Sure.
Okay.
I can do that.
Thank
Once
you.
Once this is approved, we can put the programs, and we can tell you when we start them, and we can let you know if there's any issues going forward.
Can we go back to that, the explanation of that slide, though, and what that slide says? Is it the clarity that if we run the system continuously as we're running it today, the amount of time, and I think you said in your earlier part of the presentation, we really didn't use the weekend time anymore because it was not effective. You couldn't put enough people out and get the work done. So the preventive maintenance was mixed in with all of the incidents that were occurring rather than preventive maintenance on a regular basis and then doing the incidents. So it wasn't like people were sitting in their offices doing nothing. It wasn't, they were not doing the work in a manner that they were keeping up with the system. And that's that.
I'm sure that's a good explanation, but I didn't know that certain systems were being deleted or stopped.
That may be the point, but I will tell you, I've been here long enough and I've heard in four cycles that when you say you want longer hours and you got longer hours, you got less maintenance time. So that is the answer to the question. And that is the same question we're being asked today. Okay. Yes.
Mr. Leader and Mr. Ott, thank you very much. This is a very helpful presentation. What I'm still trying to grapple with is what you're going to use this time for as opposed to what would have been in a, I guess in my mind, a SafeTracks 2.0. So let me frame the question like this. You indicate that you're going to use this extra time for a preventive maintenance program, and you identify five programs: the traction, power, mega ring, testing, tamping, et cetera. But SafeTracks 1 dealt with the above ground system. It really didn't do anything in terms of replacing track, ties, cabling, third rail in the tunnels, in the underground part of the system. So what I'm trying to understand is how do you get that work done that still has to be done in the tunnels? Is that work that gets done during this overnight period of the increased hours? Is that work that gets done with shutdowns on the weekend that we're experiencing now? Or does that get done when you find a problem with single tracking during the off-peak hours Monday through Friday to get that kind of work done, replacing rails, replacing ties, replacing third rail, replacing cabling? Where does that big part of the actual rebuild get done when you go to this preventive maintenance model?
Yes, sir. We will continue to leverage weekend single tracks and weekend shutdowns to do safe track-like work after safe track. The efficiencies we gain from replacing ties, you know, under shutdowns will need to continue. The underground work, specifically, doing fasteners is something we can get done with an effective production rate during normal work windows, just due to the amount of equipment and materials required to do that type of work. I think you mentioned, you know, safe track was really all about changing ties, changing rail, replacing cables. The programs we presented today under the preventive maintenance program, there is no changing ties, changing rail, and things of that nature. It's a very different program that's focused on, you know, moving the reliability needle and getting out in front of some of these failures.
So my question is, don't you still have to do that, replacing ties, replacing tracks, fasteners, cabling for the underground system, for the basic 70 or 80 miles that are in the tunnels?
Yes, sir. That will never stop.
And when does that get done? That's what I'm trying to identify. Is that getting done in these overnight hours? Or is that getting done on the weekends? Or is that getting done where Monday through Friday you're going to have to do single tracking in the off-peak hours? Or all of the above?
All of the above, sir. I mean, we're going to continue to leverage every available window we can to meet our annual state of good repair requirements.
Thank you.
Okay. Are those all the questions? I'm sorry. I'll start with Mr. Domship and then I'll start.
First of all, thanks for the presentation. And my question has to do with the efficiency of the crews that need to mobilize. Is it true that we transport station manager staff by rail after the service has been suspended? I mean, do we move station managers around by rail?
Yes. Some stations, due to the fact that the system is shut down, and in order to expedite the opening of the stations, you know, or the closing of the stations, some of our station managers are moved by what is known as the, what do we call it?
Employee train.
The employee train.
Right.
And that is probably the last train that goes through, and in the morning, the same thing would happen. Other areas, station managers can get there, mm-hmm. you know, but there's certain key stations that we move them by train.
Okay. So I get the opening of the station and using the employee train. I'm a little concerned about the use of the employee train at the end of the shift. So essentially, we have a situation where there's a dependency between the station manager's responsibilities that are not related to preventive maintenance at all. It's just closing the station down. So if there's a delay at a particular station, then the train has to wait for that employee, and then the crews have to wait for that train to get off the track. So, I mean, have we contemplated a way of maybe using ground transportation to get those folks out of the station and,
yes,
and get the focus on what we're trying to do here? Because that green box, the hour, I think that's an area of opportunity.
No, I'll explain the green and the orange. Just to let you know, we are looking at that. Is there a different means we could transport the station managers to or from the station? However, the green box, what Andy was trying to depict there is, although we say we shut down at midnight, our revenue trains are still running
to
a certain hour.
The orange box.
So I think he mentioned 12:40, and other lines it could be as much as 1 o'clock.
Okay. So is it reasonable that over time – is it reasonable that over time you guys would get better at this?
Yes.
Okay. So is it reasonable that instead of having a fixed a closure time over a 12-month period of time that we might be able to see a proposal that shows a taper, i.e. that we begin the closures at 1 a.m. as the general manager has commented about, and then maybe 6 months later it's 2, and then 6 months later it's 3.
No, I just think, you know, we as I mentioned before, we need to look, when it comes to efficiencies, we need to look at a lot of areas, and it will take some time, it will take some retooling to do, and to suggest that we could go into a taper right now is not the answer.
Thank you. Again, thank you for your presentation. I have two questions, one looking back and one looking forward. So there came a point in time in the system's history when we went from the hours we had to more hours of running trains. We instituted the 3 a.m. closing time, which reduced the amount of time we had to work on the tracks. But in the comparisons with other systems, it wasn't out of line with what other systems had to work on their tracks as well. So for the last, whenever that happened, 2010, whatever it is, till the present, the system deteriorated enormously. So even though we had this time on the tracks, albeit less time than we used to have, the system just deteriorated. And I know none of you were here, nor was I, but can someone explain what happened? How did we have this amount of time, which was relatively the same amount of time that other systems had, and yet our system just completely deteriorated? And were we not using the time rightly? Did we not have enough money? What was the reason that happened? Because it leads to my next question.
I want to answer part of that question because I think I can. Having been in the industry for 30 years, or over 30 years now, and having the opportunity to travel to various agencies, I can honestly tell you every maintenance organization will tell you they don't have enough time. So you People could sit there and say they stay open to 1, they stay open to 2 o'clock in the morning, they stay open to 3. The maintenance forces are dying to get down on the tracks and get the work performed. There's no miracle. Everybody is suffering the same way. Prior to coming here, I worked as a consultant in another organization, and I can tell you from a maintenance perspective, they were dying to get work done. And they were being held up by some of the same issues we're dealing with here. I can't really tell you what happened here. I can tell you there's steps that we're trying to put in place, that we have put in place, to try and never get back here. We have a prior presentation. Andy mentioned that we have an outside consultant that's coming in to look at the overall track condition and to give us an assessment based on how many years of life. Okay, we call it a condition survey or an asset survey. So we're trying to put in place protocols and procedures that will prevent us from ever going back to where we are. But to say what happened, I really can't. I can't tell you. I don't have the answers.
Okay. Then my second question is, assume for the sake of discussion, you need these extra hours. And assume for the sake of discussion, you can't have them on Friday and Saturday nights, that we want to stay open till 3 both nights. Where would you suggest that we get these hours? What plan can you put together that gives you the exact hours and time that you need on the tracks that don't involve Friday and Saturday nights?
Well, we could look at other alternatives. I think we have an option that we believe is good for us, but I can tell you, if it means going into the early morning hours in other scenarios, it's going to be, you know, giving us more hours, it's going to probably cost overtime. So whatever we do, you could look at hours in different ways, but based on how, you know, you would bring workers in, it could have an effect in other areas. So, you know, you could throw up any scenario you want.
If I could, the one thing is clear is that we are going to have to do the work. And so we will have to do that so either we're going to continue this mode of going in and doing the things as they're coming up, and which then impacts throughout the day as they come, as Andy just talked about. We had 6 slow speed situations. And so that is a change of philosophy, which is basically we're not going to ignore these things and let them pile up and then lead to something else. We're going to attack them. So if we don't have the hours at other time, it's going to have to impact revenue service time, because we can't ignore them any longer.
But Paul, what I'm saying is, if you instead of closing the system till 3 o'clock at midnight on Friday and Saturday, close the system some other time. And what time would that
be?
Sure.
Well, I mean, I think that's the options that we put on the table. You know, we've given 4 ranges of options, and you know, but at the end of the day, it still gets to that same issue: is there's only so much time, and if we squeeze it here, do we squeeze it there? But what I am saying is, you know, when we come upon issues, we are not going to just let them sit and then let them pile up and think we're going to get to them during the smaller amounts of time we had, because I think that's what has gotten us here, again, over a long period of time. And I think that gets to your earlier question, is how did we get here? Well, it's because we pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And at some point, like the example with Chicago, it starts to get towards that end of its usefulness, and then it starts to go, and then you have to get in and do it. And that's where we are. So we're trying to reverse that curve, you know, pull this thing out of the deep slope it's in to bring it up. But we are not going to, from a safety perspective, we're not going to put things off. We're going to deal with them as they come up.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for the presentation. Sorry about the time, but I do think it's time that's invested. I think the decision that we're going to make, I have to tell you, that will be impactful on someone. Something. And so I think it's important that we understand what's in a part of that decision and what we're asking of staff in order to get us where we'd like to be. We looked at the vital signs before, and we talked about reliability and all of those things. All is tied up in this decision. It's not one part or the other. And I think the customers hopefully can hear this discussion to see where we are going with the input that they've given us, as well as what the input the staff has given us. So thank you very much, and this is not an action item, and so we are finished for today. Thank you for your presentation. Thank you for your participation.